Turn that guitar up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Red Beard. This week in the studio, it's the anniversary of one of the cornerstones of hard rock from Deep Purple.
We were sitting in this kind of bar restaurant, which was overlooking the lake, Lake Geneva, and about maybe a quarter of a mile from the casino, which had really taken. The flames were going 200-300 feet in the air, and it was an inferno. And the wind was coming down off the mountains and blowing the flames and the smoke across the lake, and the smoke was just like a stage show. It was hanging on the water. Never forget, Roger grabbed a napkin and wrote down on this napkin, "Smoke on the water."
And it was actually, the whole thing was recorded under dire circumstances. It was very cold, and we were in this corridor. It's beyond belief, actually, the desperation with which we were trying to finish this record. A lot of Machine Head, a lot of that was written on the spot. Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio talking to Redbeard about Machine Head, because it's the anniversary of that album. How about that?
Listening to the finished product and judging by its iconic place in hard rock history, you would have no indication to realize that Deep Purple's Machine Head was recorded in a virtual minefield of hardships, any one of which had the potential to thwart the effort. Lead singer Ian Gillan and bass player Roger Glover of Deep Purple tell tales about the making of Machine Head that you simply cannot make up. In the All Music Guide, Ed Rivadavia calls Deep Purple's 1972 Machine Head album, along with Led Zeppelin's 4th and Black Sabbath's Paranoid, and I quote, "the holy trinity of English hard rock and heavy metal, serving as the fundamental blueprints followed by virtually every hard rock and roll band since. Machine Head contains the mother of all guitar riffs, one of the first learned by every beginning guitarist in Smoke on the Water." In top form was lead singer Ian Gillan, who crooned and exploded with amazing power and range throughout to establish himself once and for all as one of the finest voices of his generation, bar none. Rivadavia closes his 5-star review of Machine Head with "one of the essential hard rock albums of all time." But what's most remarkable about Deep Purple's biggest album is how perilously close it came to being scrapped entirely. You see, it was autumn 1971, and the band had concluded touring the U.S. in support of the Fireball album, a creative step forward, but only modestly successful, at least in the U.S. Deep Purple bass player Roger Glover begins the story in the studio.
It used to be that we did an album a year. Well, I mean, looking back at that kind of schedule, I can't imagine doing it now. But it used to be an album a year, and in between, just touring everywhere. We mostly around Europe. After the American tour, we went back to Europe and toured a bit more, and at some point, we obviously said, well, we got to do another album. And during the making of Fireball, actually two things occurred about then. First, we noticed that the drums sounded a lot better in the corridor than in the studio. Pacey was tuning up his snare drum. He put a new skin on it, and he was walking down the corridor into the studio. And he noticed the sound as he went from the corridor to the studio. Suddenly, it went completely dead. Went from a big crashing noise to this, bass-trapped nothingness. No reverb, no surfaces to bounce off or anything like that. And they said, well, sod this, I'm going to set up my drums in a corridor. It sounds better. So that's what he did.
Strange Kind of Woman from Fireball was a hit in the UK, Europe, and Japan, but failed to score in the US. Again, Roger Glover of Deep Purple.
We'd started finally to make a bit of money. It was actually not until Fireball that we actually started, we were paying back debts up until the end of Fireball. So we started making a bit of money, and we had a very creative accountant, very, very nice man, who said, well, you could save some tax if you wrote and recorded outside the country. Oh, yeah? So, yeah, if you write everything, and you just can't be in England, can't be in the UK. So we thought, well, that's actually not a bad plan. Let's go somewhere else to record it. So with the experience of Pacey's corridor drum setup in mind, we thought, well, why don't we do a recording in a venue just get a venue and to book it for 3 weeks or something like that, and get the feel of the stage. You know, you don't have an audience there, but you're on the stage, and that we were getting so used to the sound of us playing live by this point that studios seemed kind of constricting. There were such things as mobile studios. There were, I believe, two in existence at that time. One of which was the Rolling Stones Mobile, which was generally considered the best. So we said, right, well, let's have that, and we'll find somewhere. And I don't know how many calls were made all around Europe. Where is it going to be? But we'd played the casino. It was regular part of the circuit. If you were playing Tour of Europe, you'd play the casino. You'd play Geneva, you'd play Zurich, and you'd play Montreux. And we played it a couple of times. And Claude Nobbs, who basically runs the casino, Montreux Jazz Festival, it turned out that the casino at Montreux was going to be roughly free in the month of December, November through December. And we thought, well, that's a good venue. Let's go there. And basically, very simple. We just booked the Rolling Stones Mobile, which turned up. We flew in. And that's where we're going to do it.
Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan told me that the decision to record Machine Head at the casino at Montreux, Switzerland, wasn't so surprising.
We have always had a kind of aversion to recording studios for various reasons. I think the one thing about Purple, we've never really developed a great deal of professionalism in the studio. We're not very good studio workers. We're still quite, apart from Roger, of course, who lives in studios, but the rest of us, I think, are probably still, for our advanced years, quite naive about studio techniques and technology and everything else. I think we tend to concentrate very much on the musical side, and we find it restricting. It's a bit synthetic. It's a bit antiseptic.
If you look on the CD package of Machine Head, you'll see a picture of bass player Roger Glover playing a Rickenbacker bass guitar during the Machine Head recording sessions. As it turns out, Roger's lucky it's not a mug shot.
We'd been in America about a month before. I'd bought a Rickenbacker guitar in New York, and I was staying in New York an extra day, and everyone was going back, and the roadie took it back, and for some reason, at the shop that I bought the thing from, I said, you know, any chance of a receipt that's showing it a bit less, because I'm trying to save a bit of money. I had no money, and I was trying to save £25 in customs, in excise duty. So they gave me a receipt saying it was, you know, cost less than it did. The receipt was in the case, and the case went with the roadie to England. And he called me up after he got to England. I'm still in the States now, in New York. And he said, they've seized your guitar. I said, what? Why? He said, well, they didn't believe the price, and they arrested me, and they're waiting for you when you come in tomorrow. So I flew in the next day with my story, which was, had given me a receipt that I hadn't asked for, thinking that that's, you know, they did it for all musicians, etc. So anyways, I got to the customs place at the Heathrow Airport. Ah, Mr. Glover, can you open your case, please? So they opened the cases and went through everything. I mean, to the point where you'd have to say, you know, can I help you? They were going through every page of my address book, for example. I mean, and then they finally brandished this receipt, and they said, do you recognize this? Well, no, first of all, they said, how much, you bought a new guitar, how much did you pay for it? So I told them the truth. And then they brandished the receipt and said, well, do you recognize this? I said, well, it looks like mine, but it's wrong because the amount's wrong. Innocent boy that I was. Cut a long story short, and it's too late for that. I was interviewed by three different people, and I stuck to my story right until the very end when the last guy came in and he sat on the desk right towering over me and said, okay, Glover, what's this bullshit? And this is after 3 hours now, so I actually gave up and said, yeah, it's a false receipt. I was trying to save your money. Well, you're hereby arrested. Anything you say may be taken down, used in evidence. God. And I said, well, fine. You know, they said you have to go to court. I said, well, I'm leaving in 2 weeks to go to Switzerland. And I said, can I get the guitar back? And they said, no, that's impounded. That's gone. I said, well, there must be a way I can get it. I just bought it. If you agree to pay the full fine for both yourself and your road manager and the excise duty, and, you know, it cost me about three times as much as the guitar. But I did get the guitar back, thankfully, and I took it over to Switzerland.
Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Deep Purple's Ian Gillan and Roger Glover on the 45th anniversary of Machine Head.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio talking to Redbeard about Machine Head because it's the anniversary of that album. How about that?
No sooner did the members of Deep Purple arrive in Montreux, Switzerland, on the shores of Lake Geneva, to record their next album at the hall there, than events began to quickly unfold. Here's first Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan, followed by bass player Roger Glover.
We flew into Montreux in Switzerland, and we went to watch, this is the famous part of it, we went to watch Frank Zappa show at the casino. This was the night before we were due to start recording there. And our mobile studio, the Rolling Stones mobile that we were renting, was parked outside. Claude Nobbs, who was the main man in Montreux, organizes the jazz festival and everything else, had sorted us out. And we were staying at the Eden O'Lac Hotel just down the road. We turned up to see the Zappa show, sat in some really nice seats right in front of the stage. And towards the end of the show, which was spectacular, I remember it to this day, because they had Flo and Eddie in the band at that time, and it was superb. And some guy came in with a flare gun, shot it into the roof, and the whole thing caught fire.
Roger Glover of Deep Purple.
And then someone fired a flare gun into the ceiling, which is a bamboo ceiling. And at first nothing happened, but, you know, music stopped, and I guess they got the official word, you know, we're going to have to clear the place out. So Frank Zappa, you know, said, you know, don't want to alarm anyone, but fire! Anyway, we all trooped out, and I remember trooping back in myself because I lost the others in the rush, and I walked back into the empty hall, and I stood in front of the stage looking at Frank Zappa's gear because I'd never seen a synthesizer before. And George Duke had a couple of these synthesizers, which were all wires and knobs, unlike synthesizers today. And just for a couple of minutes, I looked, you know, nice gear. Anyway, they're not here, walked out. But luckily, because about a minute later, the place just erupted. The fire had started in the ceiling and it had spread without anyone seeing it, as it does, you know. And it was a huge building. It wasn't just a casino. It was a venue. Obviously, that's where we were watching Zappa. There was a disco there, bars, restaurants, a big casino, big convention facilities. The Golden Rose of Montreux, a very famous TV award show, takes place there, even now, still going. So it was a massive building, and it was a wooden building. And bang, it just went up.
The true story of the casino fire, where they were to record this album the very next day, Deep Purple with Smoke on the Water. According to Deep Purple's Roger Glover, the surreal, massive fire and destruction gave way to sobering reality the following day.
Went up and blazed all night. And by the next morning, I remember going there the next morning to see, and it was still, you know, smoking and smoldering and little fires, and everywhere was wet because the fire brigade had just drenched the place. And it was, what a shock. I mean, a real shock. And Claude, bless him, Claude was wonderful. There's a photograph of Claude in Machine Head, taken as the fire was raging. It started about 2 or 3 hours before that. And he came by the hotel to see us. And the look on his face is evident in that picture. It's a wonderful picture. I mean, his future, his life was going up in flames. And bless him, he didn't think about that. He said, now I'm really worried about you. What are you going to do? We've got to find somewhere else. So, yeah, we looked for somewhere else. And we actually did find somewhere within a day or two, another venue in the city, a smaller place called Le Pavillon. And it was about this time I woke up a couple of days after the fire with the words smoke on the water on my lips, having said them out loud to no one. And must have been a dream or something like that. And I remember mentioning it to Ian Gillan. So a strange title came to me, Smoke in the Water. He said, oh, it sounds like a drug song. And so we actually, yeah, we didn't consider it for a few weeks. But meanwhile, we went into this Le Pavillon and started recording, set up on the stage, Rolling Stones, Mowell outside, Martin Birch, all there. And we did one track before the police stopped us. And the police actually, while we were recording that track, the police were hammering on the door and the roadies were keeping it closed because it was loud. It was hugely loud, and we were keeping the entire town of Montreux awake. Well, Montreux sits on Lake Geneva, which is quite beautiful, big, big lake. And we were actually, you know, by the time we'd got all the sounds and worked out the arrangements of this riff that Richie had, he just started playing this riff, and we said, oh, you know, by the time we worked it out, it was about 1 a.m. And we're belting away, you know, really loud, and obviously there's no soundproofing or anything like that. It wasn't a studio. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me if, yeah, the French government were calling up saying, hey, what's that noise? Because it's France across the other side of the lake, you see. Anyway, we had to abandon that idea. And there followed 4 or 5 days of, you know, verging on desperation.
Showing terrific chops for a rock and roll band, Deep Purple features John Lord on organ, Ritchie Blackmore on guitar, and Ian Paice on drums on the song Lazy from 1972's Machine Head. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Deep Purple's Ian Gillan and Roger Glover on the 45th anniversary of Machine Head.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio talking to Redbeard about Machine Head because it's the anniversary of that album. How about that?
Thanks again, mate. So let's recap. Deep Purple had rented a giant mobile recording truck and traveled to Montreux, Switzerland at Lake Geneva to do their Machine Head album in 1972. But on the day they arrived, the place where they would record burned down. They found a suitable replacement, but after recording only one song, the local police in the quiet resort town shut them down. So I asked bass player Roger Glover of Deep Purple, what next?
Well, headed to the bar. Band meetings always took place around the bar. Anyway, Claude was wonderful. You know, I mean, he really tried to help us. I mean, the casino was in ruins, but he was running around looking after us. And Montreux then, I mean, it's changed somewhat now, but then it was a very small, sleepy town, very upper class, lots of tea shops and lots of little old ladies going out in the afternoon for tea. And it was very quiet. It was the place you retired to for the most part. I think there was one club, a couple of restaurants, a very quiet place. And, you know, we're looking for somewhere where we can make a lot of noise in the middle of the night. That's a pretty tall order. But no, there was nothing that really, really worked. And we'd heard about someone, I think Claude probably came up and said, well, there's this hotel that's closed down. It's worth a look at. So we drove to this place. It's about a kilometer or two out from the center of Montreux. And it was a hotel. It was closed down for the season. And we walked in. It was cold. There was no heating on. But it had a ground floor corridor that was made of marble. And it was high ceilings. Yeah, we could do this. Looked around, and well, we could actually help ourselves by soundproofing it a little bit. So we got a carpenter who built a couple of false walls just to sort of seal the corridor off, and we put mattresses up on the windows, and basically that's where we set up. It was a long trek to go and listen to a take once we'd made a recording. We had to go through something like 29 doors to get to the foyer and out into the truck. You'd have to go into a bedroom, into the bathroom, into an adjoining bathroom, out into a balcony, and in the outside, along the balcony, to another bedroom, in there, through the bathroom, through another bedroom, and out into the main corridor which led to the foyer, just to listen to a playback. You know, it took, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to walk it. And I remember as we walked through the bedrooms and out into the balcony, I mean, the view was incredible, because there's the lake stretched out, and in the distance, the French Alps looming the other side of the lake. And it got to the point where as we walked past, I mean, the first time we walked that route, well, wow, look at that. Look at the Alps, French Alps. And then the second time, yeah, French Alps. And it became a little catchword. You know, every time we walked out, someone would mutter, French Alps. We got an industrial heater in, you know, a big kind of cylinder thing. And it was the roadie's job to get to the place, you know, a couple of hours before we were due to start and turn this thing on to heat the room up, the corridor. And it was actually, the whole thing was recorded under dire circumstances. It was very cold, and we were in this corridor. I mean, it's beyond belief, actually, the desperation with which we were trying to finish this record. I was in the car, this is some years ago now. I got into my car, and I was driving there. I turned the radio on, and this music was playing. And I thought, oh, wow, this is great, and I turned it up. And I was really into it for about 3 or 4 seconds before I realized it was us. And that was, you know, you don't normally get a chance to be that subjective when listening to your own stuff because you know it. But I didn't, and that was Space Trucking. It was a middle section of Space Trucking, you know, where it goes all funky and chunky. And I thought, wow, this is great. So, and that really gave me an insight as to, you know, how I view that album. And listening to the live version of Smoke and then doing the anniversary remixes, I mean, I do think it's a really, really strong album. In its heyday when it was really big and in the charts and Smoke and the Water was, you know, close to the top of the American charts. It's real life, and as it's happening, you kind of just accept it, even though it's wonderful, but you can't grab hold of time. There's a recording of us doing Highway Star, and Ian Gillan introduces us. I said, well, here's a new song for you. It's probably going to be our opening song for the next year or so. You know, you never expect anything quite so amazing to happen. But certainly Machine Head has been the towering monument in whose shadow we still lie. I don't think we could do a gig without playing. You know, Machine Head became the live set upon which everything else was based, much to the hardcore fans' annoyance, by the way. But yeah, we'll add and change things here and there. But basically, Machine Head has been the sort of blueprint for all our shows since then.
In 2016, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame made space for Deep Purple, whose latest album, Infinite, is out now. See Deep Purple in concert in Europe with the Alice Cooper Band beginning May 13th through mid-June. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Ian Gillan and Roger Glover. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online, at inthestudio.net.